ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you think you'd never be caught out by disinformation? Well, cast your mind back. Remember that big story about the bedbugs at the Paris Olympics? Well, that was actually a very effective Russian disinformation campaign. So effective that most people still believe it to this day. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. And I've learned that disinformation can be surprisingly subtle and hard to spot. If you want to join me interrogating the dark world of disinformation, stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
Some countries pride themselves for upholding human rights. And the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney recently graced our shores in an exercise in middle power unity. Canada is often called the land of human rights, valuing tolerance, diversity, fairness, a fair go. Sound familiar? Australia claims the same ambition, but is our reality falling short of our promises? Natasha Mitchell here with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, bringing you the fifth and final 2025 Massey Lecture from our colleagues at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC. And you can catch all the episodes in this special series on ABC Listen or wherever you get your pods. Just look for Big Ideas. Now, it's easy, isn't it, to point the finger at human rights abuses and atrocities in other countries. But are the so-called good guys as good as they make out? Alex Neave is a human rights lawyer, adjunct professor at the University of Ottawa, author of Universal, Renewing Human Rights in a Fractured World, and he served as head of Amnesty International Canada for two decades. And he argues that this gap between our self-image and reality prevents us from reckoning honestly with what needs to change at home and in the world. His argument in defence of universal human rights is challenging, it's urgent, timely, but it's also hopeful. And he starts today at a devastating front line, inside one family.
Universal, true for all cases. Not true, though, for Sama Toubel, 8 years old. The agony and terror of her life in Gaza was already unbearable. And then she began to lose her hair. Once long and lustrous, because of the unimaginable fear and shock she lives through every day. In words that would pierce anyone's heart, she told her mother, "Mama, I'm tired. I want to die. Why won't my hair grow? I want to die and have my hair grow in paradise, God willing." Sama's family first fled their home in Jabalia in the north of Gaza. Following Israeli military orders, they moved to Rafah in the south, assured it would be safe. But there, a neighbor's house was hit by an Israeli airstrike in August 2024. That is when she began to lose her hair, and it has not stopped since. Every time my hair starts to grow, I look at it with hope, but then it falls out again. Sama's family fled again to a displacement camp in Khan Yunis in central Gaza. Some Gazans started to return to the north, but Sama's family could not. Their home had been destroyed under Israeli bombardment. Has the fragile ceasefire, already unraveling, brought any respite for Sama and her family? Have they fled again? Have they found food to eat to survive? Has their camp been shelled? Do they live? We cannot abide a world in which an 8-year-old girl is tired and wants to die because of the bombs raining down around her. The universal human rights promise does, occasionally and fleetingly, glimmer in Gaza. In March, a ribbon of red ran across Gaza's destruction, a red-covered table stretching for several hundred meters, carved a path of humanity through mounds of rubble under which so many bodies remain buried. There, in Rafah, families gathered to break their fast on the first night of Ramadan. "We decided to bring joy back to this street, just as it was before the war," said one of the communal iftar organizers, Malak Fada. Fleeting red ribbons of hope and defiance, but for the people of Gaza after 24 months of genocide, there is no sliver of truth to the universal human rights promise. that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. And that broken promise is an indictment of us all. Writing 800 years ago, the Persian poet Rumi beautifully encapsulated the essence of that yet-to-be-crafted universal human rights promise. Be a lamp or a lifeboat or a ladder. The promise is a lamp to the way ahead. It is a lifeboat to take us to safe harbor. It is a ladder to lift us up. Rumi does not suggest we look to others to provide the lamp, lifeboat, and ladder, but that we be those things ourselves. The human rights promise is not only something we are owed, but something we must rise to as our shared responsibility. When faced with the ravages of the Second World War and the abomination of the Holocaust, the world's response was not to look away, but to proclaim the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which became the lamp, lifeboat, and ladder all in one. And there have been many remarkable moments since when the light has shone. We have been safely afloat, and we have lifted each other up. But so often, and for so many, the light was not only extinguished but never lit, the lifeboat was not only lost at sea, it was never launched, and the ladder was not merely missing a rung or two, it remained at the back of the garage. That betrayal has been reflected in humanity's darkest moments of genocide and repression, and the economic, political, and social structures, historic and contemporary, that have embedded the deep injustices of sexism and misogyny, racism, bigotry, and intolerance, entrenched poverty, colonialism, and environmental collapse in the lives of billions of people. We have consistently failed to deliver the most fundamental dimension of the human rights promise, that it is universal. That failure means we live in a world in which carbon emissions rise and fossil fuel companies benefit from billions of dollars of government subsidies, all while catastrophic weather destroys communities everywhere. That failure means we live in a world which looks on from afar as the Taliban strip women and girls in Afghanistan of their rights and seek to erase them from public life. That failure means we live in a world where Rohingya refugees forced to live in closed camps in Bangladesh with no prospect of returning home to safety in Myanmar are expected to survive on $6 per month. That failure means we live in a world in which we stood by and watched a genocide unfold in Gaza, even as the UN Secretary General described Gaza as a killing field where civilians are in an endless death loop. That failure means we live in a world in which two white men, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, amass wealth of over $500 billion between them, while 700 million people survive on less than $2.15 per day. That failure means we live in a world in which the foreboding doomsday clock is now the closest ever to the end of humanity. Yet, nuclear weapons arsenals are being upgraded. That failure means we live in a world in which the most vulnerable members of society are cavalierly thrown under the bus of hate, while hate mongers dominate political discourse and run amok in our virtual world. And that failure means we live in a country where, faced with our responsibility to reckon with the irrefutable genocidal history of residential schools, disinformation and anti-Indigenous racism fuel a movement of denialism. But in the face of that failure, hundreds of people from over 40 countries joined the Sumud flotilla in the Mediterranean, intent on piercing Israel's genocidal blockade of Gaza. In the face of that failure, Gen Z protesters around the world decry inequality, corruption, and authoritarianism, and over 7 million people across the United States joined No Kings protests, standing up for democracy. In the face of that failure, Innu elder Elizabeth Panashawe does not waver or falter from decades of defending her people's land in Labrador. And in the face of that failure, unheralded and unknown students, refugees, grandmothers, farmers, factory workers, artists, doctors, community leaders, and grassroots activists everywhere mount acts of resistance, small and large, because they believe in universal human rights. We Canadians are inclined to feel self-satisfied about human rights. In a survey a decade ago, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms ranked as the symbol that best expressed Canadian identity, ahead of the flag, the RCMP, our national anthem, and even hockey. A 2022 poll ranked the Charter and our healthcare system equally. It is our global image as well. In 2001, in a temporary transit camp for Sierra Leonean refugees in Guinea, West Africa, our Amnesty International delegation sat with a group of elders while a wider circle of people listened in. I was the only Canadian on the team, and after I finished speaking, one man stood up, shook my hands, turned to the assembled group, and assured everyone that all would be well because Canada was the land of human rights. There are indeed many reasons to take pride in Canada's contributions to universal human rights. That includes such consequential breakthroughs as UN peacekeeping, the landmines ban, the International Criminal Court, and strengthened protections for child soldiers. Canada's resettlement of Indochinese refugees earned us the Nansen Award, the equivalent of the Nobel Peace Prize for refugee protection. Canada has generally been a leading advocate globally for women's equality, including sexual and reproductive rights, and for the rights of 2SLGBTQI plus individuals. We defied our US and UK allies to oppose apartheid in South Africa, and we said no to George Bush's unlawful invasion of Iraq. All true. But new chapters are being written as we tangle with Donald Trump. We try to distance ourselves from his chaos and cruelty, yet the universal human rights dial is shifting, and governments, including our own, gravitate to where he has set the debate. That has meant massive increases in military spending and border enforcement, to the detriment of already sparse global humanitarian budgets, which are more urgently needed than ever. We have remained silent as Donald Trump eviscerates the rights of refugees and migrants. Instead, we maintain the indefensible line that there is no need to suspend the Safe Third Country Agreement between our two countries because the United States remains safe for refugees. Such reticence underscores a pernicious impact of the Trump agenda. Reluctant to push back and worried about reprisals, the international community, including Canada, risks normalizing what he has unleashed. Many world leaders eagerly join him in shredding the universal human rights promise. Canada's response cannot be indifference, but bold determination to take a different path. There has never been a more important time to be that fabled land of human rights. But it means getting our own house in order. Our house will not be in order until we meaningfully address the history and contemporary reality of genocide, disposition, and racism against Indigenous peoples. Canada's most disgraceful and unresolved story. A country that was founded with cruel determination to take the Indian out of the child has far to go in meeting the universal promise of human rights. Canada's humiliating initial opposition to the game-changing UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples has given way to support, and the declaration has been incorporated into Canadian law. But the rights of Indigenous peoples are still violated daily through racism in policing and corrections, resistance to addressing the legacy of residential schools, ongoing violence against Indigenous women and girls, discrimination in accessing safe water, housing, education, healthcare, and child protection, and sacrificing Indigenous land and treaty rights in the face of dams, pipelines, mines, and development projects. Universalizing the human rights promise in Canada, therefore, must start with honoring the rights of Indigenous peoples.
On ABC Radio National from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. This is the final of the CBC Massey Lectures that we've been bringing you. I'm Natasha Mitchell. This year's orator is international human rights lawyer, leader, activist and advocate Alex Neave. And here he is now on why countries like Australia and his own, Canada, should stop being hypocritical over whose human rights we value and whose we ignore. What will it take to get our human rights house in order?
Our house will not be in order if we are selective in our diplomacy, championing the rights of some people while wholly disregarding the rights of others. Canada's long-standing policy with respect to Israel and Palestine trumpets our steadfast friendship with Israel, but fails to say the same about Palestinians. In fact, we have a long history of sidelining and penalizing groups and individuals who promote the rights of Palestinians. It reflects what is often termed the Palestine exception. There is equality, there is freedom of expression, and there are human rights, except when it involves Palestine. When it comes to supporting the role of the International Court of Justice and International Criminal Court in addressing the situation in Gaza, Canada's ambivalent stance at best and silence at worst stands in stark contrast to our firm position on cases before those two courts dealing with genocide against the Rohingya, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or torture in Syria. The Universal Human Rights Promise has no space for double standards. Our house will not be in order as long as business interests continue to take precedence over human rights and the environment. Canada remains a laggard when it comes to reducing our high level of carbon emissions. The impact of the mounting climate crisis, particularly the devastating fires that are destroying huge swaths of the country, has become dire. Yet, we are a dismal 62 among 67 countries on the 2025 Climate Change Performance Index. Federal and provincial governments provide billions of dollars of support to fossil fuel companies. And debate about the climate crisis in this year's federal election? Barely a whisper. It is an uphill battle as well to press governments of any stripe to take human rights seriously in trade policy. For years, we were told by Liberal and Conservative ministers alike that the best strategy for improving human rights in China was to establish a business-friendly climate. The rule of law, after all, crucial for upholding contracts, would then trickle down to human rights. Business has indeed expanded, but human rights violations across China have only worsened. Our newest free trade agreement with Ecuador is dismissive of human rights concerns. Hortensia Jawe, an indigenous activist from Ecuador, notes, "It's hard enough already to defend ourselves against the Canadian mining company's attempts to advance projects without our consent. It will be even harder if the power of mining companies is strengthened by this free trade agreement." There is no world in which leaving universal human rights out of climate, business, and trade policy leads to a better future. Our house will not be in order until we learn the lessons from our grievous failures to respect human rights in national security activities. Not only have there been grave consequences for numerous Canadian citizens, including Meher Arar, Abdullah Al-Malki, and Omar Khadr, there has been a considerable cost for the Canadian taxpayer. The price tag for the human rights settlements to debate, not counting massive legal costs, has been in the range of $60 million. But these hard-learned lessons are ignored. Canadian citizens Hassan Diab and Abousfian Abdelrazik have been abandoned to national security and justice for close to 20 years, forced to fight in the courts of law and public opinion for redress. Our house will not be in order unless we take our international obligations seriously. At a time when so many countries discredit and attack the international human rights regime, it is vital that countries like Canada show scrupulous respect for that international system. But we too have a less than proud record when it comes to complying with our international obligations. UN recommendations are ignored or lost in the vagaries of federal-provincial finger-pointing. That is particularly so when it comes to economic and social rights, dealing with such vital concerns as poverty, housing, and healthcare, rights that governments in Canada still often treat as being of secondary importance. A case in point is the federal government's refusal to respect a UN committee's finding that denying access to essential healthcare on the basis of immigration status is discriminatory and violates the right to life. A forum of ministers on human rights, which brings federal, provincial, and territorial governments together to discuss international human rights responsibilities, has yet to find its footing. Government decisions about signing on to human rights treaties are shrouded by secrecy. And let us not forget the growing inclination of politicians in Canada to evade human rights responsibilities through resort to the Charter's notwithstanding clause, singling out groups whose human rights standing is already fragile, including Muslim women, transgender youth, and people living in homeless encampments. And this week, we add teachers in Alberta to that list. All of which sends a message that it is acceptable to selectively choose when and if to respect human rights. We might as well hang a sign in our window, be as universal or not as you wish. There is another path. As Professor Pam Palmiter, citizen of the Mi'kmaq Nation and member of Eel River Bar First Nation, told my international human rights class at the University of Ottawa, imagine all the good we can do and the better country and world we would live in for Indigenous peoples and all of humanity if we actually gave human rights their turn, just as we have always said we would. Indeed, it is time to fully and completely give human rights their turn. In fact, we must thoroughly reimagine the place of universal human rights in our world. This is a moment to overhaul our systems and structures, elevate human rights, and challenge ourselves to live our lives differently. A time for renewal, building on what we have created while reconceiving something different with a heightened sense of purpose. The universal human rights renewal that I imagine has six key elements. Put human rights first. Embrace universality and commit to equality. Protect human rights defenders and the right to protest. Ensure justice. Be expansive and believe in and champion human rights. It is a collective pledge, yes. It is what we demand of governments, but also it is what we must expect of ourselves. Number one, put human rights first. There is always an excuse for putting human rights on hold. One day, not now, there are other priorities, human rights will be a distraction or too expensive. Honestly, we just don't care. That anguish is captured in Omar El-Akkad's powerful book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. He writes, when finally there is no other means of preserving self-interest but to act, the powerful will act. The same people who did the killing and financed the killing and justified the killing and turned away from the killing will congratulate themselves on doing the right thing. It is very important to do the right thing eventually. What a collective global cri de cœur for Palestinians, for the rights of all peoples. Universal human rights were never intended to be for later, not left for that eventual one day. They were to be the starting point. That is why the Universal Declaration talks of human rights being the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. the solid foundation, not the leaky roof. Delaying human rights robs them of their purpose. Human rights do not rise to the top after a people have been decimated by genocide, are not something to think about after we have been ravaged by the climate crisis, and do not come to the fore after economic policy and trade deals have gutted a community of their livelihood. We need to begin with human rights. Consider the Security Council, the one body within the United Nations that has the power to issue legally binding decisions when dealing with threats to the peace, breaches of the peace, and acts of aggression, such as genocide, crimes against humanity, and widespread war crimes. However, there is the not-so-small matter of the Security Council veto, which gives the five permanent members unchecked power to defeat any resolution, three of whom, the United States, Russia, and China, veto shamelessly, including recent resolutions dealing with appalling human rights and humanitarian crises in Palestine, Syria, Ukraine, Myanmar, Sudan, Venezuela, and Mali. There have been earnest attempts to constrain the veto. France and Mexico have launched a widely supported call that the five permanent members voluntarily and collectively pledged not to use their veto in cases of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes on a large scale. A UN General Assembly resolution requires a debate in the General Assembly examining any use of the veto at the Security Council. Yet, the same three states continue to use it, wholly unconcerned by their failure to put human rights first. Consider also the world of business. There is growing recognition of the importance of companies conducting upfront human rights impact assessments of their business operations and of governments doing similarly with respect to trade deals. Civil society groups have proposed model legislation requiring Canadian businesses to carry out mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence assessments of their operations. Just imagine if that became the norm. Human rights would be thought of not as an inconvenience to be addressed when business goes awry, but as the foundational premise to getting things right from the start. To say human rights come first is an easy talking point. It will remain empty rhetoric without new ways of thinking and tangible measures to ensure that human rights are indeed our first consideration when adopting laws, setting policy, and making decisions. At a time when governments around the world are sabotaging the universal human rights promise, Canada needs to set a countervailing example. Putting human rights first at home surely requires ratifying all outstanding human rights treaties, such as those dealing with torture prevention, migrant workers, disappearances, and economic, social, and cultural rights, and also the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which is, yes, entirely about our universal human rights. Number two, embrace universality and commit to equality. You know, some of the most perceptive questions I've been asked about human rights over the years have come during school talks, anywhere from kindergarten to grade 12. This one at a high school in Edmonton cut to the chase. Since so many people's rights are violated so easily, doesn't that mean that none of us actually have human rights? She was right. When human rights are upheld for some people but not everyone, in some places not everywhere, and sometimes not always, and when some rights matter and others do not, universality is nowhere to be found. Clearly, we live in a world in which universal human rights are far more secure for white, cisgender, heterosexual, middle class and up males living in the global north, hello, than for anyone else. And what about when we tell the world that the universal promise, you know, it isn't so much about Canada. It's for the countries with more serious problems. If we take ourselves out of the universal human rights promise, why should we be surprised when other governments do the same? And what of when the promise is not extended to all rights equally? Many governments, certainly federal and provincial governments in Canada, still consider economic and social rights like housing and education to be money matters, not true rights. The phrase universal human rights is not a bromide for ministerial press releases. It must be how we govern and how we approach life. Nothing has eroded the promise of human rights in our world more than the failure to extend it universally and equally to everyone, and universally and equally with respect to all rights. Human rights will soar when their universality is embraced. That means making efforts to counter gender inequality, racism, and discrimination, hallmarks of Canadian foreign policy, at a time when equality rights are being actively challenged and shredded by so many governments, including our closest allies. Canada needs to offer substantial diplomatic, political, and financial support for diversity, equity, and inclusion around the world. Advancing equality on the world stage must also be backed up by addressing inequality at home. Top of that list must be full respect for the rights of Indigenous peoples, including genuinely acknowledging Canada's unresolved history of genocide. Human rights will not provide the protection they promise nor the solutions they offer until they are upheld universally and equally. We cannot accept anything less. Number three, protect defenders and protesters. Isabel Zuleta is a resolute Colombian human rights defender with the Movement for Living Rivers. During a 2019 cross-Canada tour, she spoke about the role of Export Development Canada in helping to finance the construction of a destructive megadam in Colombia, Hidro Ituango. She starkly conveyed how dangerous it was to speak out. Six of her colleagues had been killed, and Isabel regularly received death threats. Yet she was determined to continue. At the end of the tour, she told me, "I won't stop defending human rights because what else matters if we do not have our rights? I will continue until our rights are protected or until they silence me." In Colombia's historic 2022 elections, which brought a progressive government to power, Isabel Zuleta was elected to the Colombian Senate. She has, fortunately, been far from silenced. But to our collective shame, human rights defenders often pay with their lives simply for trying to make the universal human rights promise real. That persecution has become transnational, with numerous governments, including China, India, Russia, and Iran, killing, surveilling, and intimidating activists and journalists in other countries, including here in Canada. And more widely, when demonstrators take to the streets to defend human rights, repressive governments everywhere respond with brutal force and seek to break protest movements. We must recognize the essential role of human rights defenders and peaceful protest in society as sentinels of human rights and the lifeblood of democracy. Defenders and protesters around the world must be able to count on the Canadian government to have their back. We do so by providing greater financial and diplomatic support to frontline human rights defenders, speaking out when they are threatened or attacked, and by pushing back against repression of peaceful protest around the world. Defenders and protesters in Canada must also be respected. We need a national action plan to protect human rights defenders, including Indigenous land defenders, and to ensure they are not criminalized. More should be done as well to protect rights defenders here who are targeted by foreign governments. And we need nationwide guidelines for upholding the right to protest across the country, be it in front of Parliament, be it on university campuses, or be it in the streets. The bottom line, no one ever should be killed, threatened, or silenced for defending human rights or speaking out when they are violated. That must be universal. Number four, ensure justice. I recall the words of a Lubicon Cree elder. In many ways, it is more painful to have rights that are promised but never delivered than to have no rights promised at all. At least governments are being honest when they don't make a promise they don't intend to keep. It was a frank assessment he shared with me while I was visiting Lubicon Territory in northern Alberta in 2008. In 1990, the UN Human Rights Committee had ruled that the Canadian government had violated the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights by failing to recognize the Lubicons' land rights. The government had promised they would reach a negotiated land settlement, but 18 years on, that had not happened. In fact, it took another 10 years to finally reach that settlement. There are many UN processes meant to ensure states live up to the Universal Human Rights Promise that generates publicity, public shaming, and peer pressure. Nonetheless, states, including Canada, insist that those UN recommendations are not legally binding. Well, enforcement of the Universal Promise is nigh impossible if there is no effective remedy to turn to when rights are violated. Canada allows individuals to make UN complaints of civil and political rights, but not of economic, social, and cultural rights. How is it that I can pursue justice if my rights to free expression or a fair trial have been violated, but not if I have been denied access to adequate housing or safe water? The challenges in pursuing an effective remedy for human rights abuses by companies are so considerable that one of the three pillars to the UN's guiding principles on business and human rights is devoted to precisely that, access to remedy. It remains elusive in Canada. The Canadian Ombudsperson for Responsible Enterprise, set up in 2019, was not granted promised powers to conduct effective investigations. Frontline communities affected by the operations of Canadian mining companies find accessing Canadian courts, to say the least, a daunting prospect. And we have yet to adopt mandatory due diligence legislation that would guarantee a remedy when companies fail to address human rights and environmental harms in their overseas operations. There has been some progress, though uneven and tentative, in the drive to ensure that individuals who are responsible for mass atrocities face justice. Witness the growing caseload of the International Criminal Court. Canada, however, has not kept pace with other countries in ensuring that our national courts play their role in that struggle. Only three such cases have been launched in our own courts in 25 years. Compliance, remedies, and accountability are fundamental components of justice. And without justice, the Universal Human Rights Promise falters and ultimately fails. So on the world stage, we need to increase our support for the International Criminal Court, the establishment of which Canada championed, and we absolutely must push back when the court's personnel, including a Canadian judge, are subject to political attacks and sanctions. To remain silent is to abandon justice. Any promise rises or falls on whether it is kept. Wishful thinking is not enough. When the Universal Human Rights Promise is broken, justice must step in. Number five. Be expansive. Renewing human rights compels us to ensure the promise extends and responds to needs that were either left out or not yet imagined when the Universal Declaration was written in 1948. For human rights, while universal, are not static. They are multifaceted and dynamic, and they must evolve as we evolve. By any measure, the overriding threat to human rights in our world is the spiraling climate crisis, something that was not envisioned in the slightest in 1948. As Kumi Naidu, who has headed up both Greenpeace International and Amnesty International, succinctly puts it, there are no human rights on a dead planet. Yet action to address the climate crisis is piecemeal and woefully inadequate. In the hands of Donald Trump and other leaders, even that inadequate progress is being undone. That Canada continues to subsidize fossil fuel production in the billions of dollars simply defies belief. To ensure the planet does not die, people around the world are recognizing nature's own rights. The Magpie River in northern Quebec has been granted legal personhood, meaning it is not simply an object to exploit, but a person to be protected. The rights of Mother Earth in Ecuador and Bolivia and of the Uruwera Forest in New Zealand have been enshrined in law. The rights of the natural world are recognized in parts of Pennsylvania and in Panama. Bangladesh's Supreme Court has ruled that all rivers in the country have the right to life. In 2010, a people's conference with delegates from around the world adopted a universal declaration of the rights of Mother Earth. UBC professor David Boyd, who has served as the UN Special Rapporteur on the human right to a healthy environment, has powerfully argued that recognizing the rights of nature would benefit both the environment and human rights. Be expansive. That certainly must also extend to the distribution of wealth in our world. Oxfam rightly describes the flourishing of an ultra-wealthy class as a failure for humanity. Oxfam writes, "For too long, governments, international financial institutions, and elites have misled the world with a fictional story about trickle-down economics, in which low tax and high gains for a few would ultimately benefit us all. It is a story without any basis in truth." Of course, what we need is an economy that makes deliberate linkages to human rights in such areas as taxation, debt, public services, and climate finance. And then what of technology? As we gather in this theater, our social media feeds are no doubt humming with the latest rant from Donald Trump and the avalanche of hatefulness it has unleashed. Just one reminder of the grievous human rights harms that come with the dizzying digital advances of the past decade. Advances that also bring enormous human rights advantages. Digital technology is irreversibly embedded in our lives, but the challenge, a considerable one, is to find the sweet spot that embraces the good and banishes the bad. And we know that leaving that in the hands of social media and technology billionaires has predictably been a colossal failure. It is tempting to retreat to safeguarding existing rights frameworks that are under attack and buckling. But we must also be expansive and ensure human rights are relevant to the grave challenges of today, including by evolving our understanding of human rights.
On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, human rights lawyer and leader Professor Alex Neave on the steps countries like Canada, like Australia, can take to renew the promise of universal human rights, a promise that he has been arguing has been broken in devastating ways. He's giving the CBC Massey Lectures, Canada's version of ABC Radio National's annual Boyer Lectures here in Australia. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Continuing with the renewal, next, why silence is not an option, even when talking feels impossible.
In order for universal human rights to thrive, the planet and nature must live. Economic justice must be assured for all, and technology must serve and not imperil human rights. Lastly, number 6, believe in and champion human rights. Elie Wiesel's powerful words accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986 should be our personal and global mantra. We must always take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. Sometimes we must interfere. And I would add, the side we must interfere for is universal human rights. To take a side and to interfere, we need much deeper societal awareness of and education about human rights. What we truly need to learn is not only the knowledge that the Universal Declaration and the Charter of Rights exist and what they contain, but more profoundly, an awareness of what they offer in this time of challenge and crisis as a way forward. We need to better understand how to bring human rights into our lives. Equally, we need to rediscover our ability to converse with one another and, more critically, take those conversations to a new plane. If we do not push ourselves to listen and engage with each other honestly and courageously, how can we shore up our collective belief in human rights? In last year's Massey Lectures, Ian Williams explored the crucial imperative of remaking conversation in our time. He pointed to the deterioration in our civic and civil discourse, the new challenge of our conversations increasingly taking place in online spaces, the fact that we now live in closer proximity to people who are different from us, and the deep concern that we face aggressive attempts to silence certain voices. How critical, therefore, that we refrain from responding to insults with insults, hatred with hatred, and lies with lies, that we steer away from polarizing, dividing, and blaming. Talk less and listen more. Seek out where we can build understanding. Easy to say, not so easy to model. Not when impatience, outrage, and anger take over our emotions as we plunge into heated political discussions on social media. Yet if we are true to universal human rights, anyone whose path we cross should be assured that we respect their rights. It boils down to this: the high road is the right road, and silence is not an option. Hate does not overcome hate, and denying someone's rights in response to their denial of my rights takes us nowhere. Look for where common ground offers space to open dialogue and build understanding. Breathe, then respond. And after we breathe, we must indeed respond. Silence is not an option. Silence is destructive. Martin Luther King Jr. reminds us that in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. We must forge the world in which there is no silence because we stand together in solidarity with those whose rights are on the line. In doing so, we make it clear that we are not indifferent to genocide, to a burning planet, to sexism, racism, and discrimination, to erasing trans lives, to shutting borders, to refugees, to homelessness. And we are certainly not indifferent to our responsibility to advance rights regarding reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. We are not indifferent to efforts that tear down our common humanity, and we are not indifferent to breaking the promise of universal human rights. Wouldn't it be magnificent if we regularly convened people's human rights assemblies, bringing together Indigenous peoples, civil society, human rights commissions, governments, and the public to share perspectives, build awareness, foster greater commitment, and learn how to talk the talk and walk the walk when it comes to universal human rights? We must never forget human rights are for the people and by the people. There are so many reminders of the vitality of people power in affecting human rights change. Consider the arms trade. For decades, it has been clear that one of the most disgraceful causes of devastating human rights violations is the ease with which arms and weapons are sold and transferred globally. But the geopolitical interests involved and the massive clout of the military-industrial complex were such that convincing governments to stop providing arms to human rights violators had long proved impossible. Civil society groups, however, were unrelenting. The human toll of irresponsible arm transfers could not be ignored. I think of interviews I have carried out in the Nuba Mountains in Sudan with survivors, family members, and witnesses of indiscriminate aerial bombardment by the Sudanese Air Force. One woman described what it was like to pick up the disembodied pieces of a beloved 90-year-old neighbor who had not been able to reach the closest home-dug shelter before the bomb dropped. She spoke of how she gently gathered the woman's body parts on a woven mat, and she began to weep as she told me that she has always worried that she did not recover her entire body. During one of those research trips, there had been a wave of recent attacks, and we were able to retrieve the twisted fragments of the weapons that were being used against civilians. I returned home with a suitcase full of those deadly souvenirs, which we turned over to experts to see if their provenance could be traced. Testing of those deadly remnants pointed to cluster bombs, artillery rockets, barrel bombs, high-caliber bullets, and other weapons originating in at least 8 different countries. None of the arms had been made locally. They had all been transferred from elsewhere. It was obscene to imagine how easy it had been to do so. Naysayers doubted that governments would ever agree to rein in the global arms trade. But the worldwide network of international, national, and grassroots civil society groups demanding global rules knew otherwise. Survivors and family members told their wrenching stories again and again. The campaigns were defiant and, on occasion, bitingly satirical, such as bright yellow banana-shaped postcards that made the point that there were more rules governing the world's banana trade than the arms trade. And it worked. In 2013, the United Nations adopted the Arms Trade Treaty. Today, 117 countries are parties to that treaty. Now, there is undeniably still very far to go in ensuring states comply with the treaty, well evidenced by Canada's willingness to sell armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia amidst widespread war crimes in Yemen, and obfuscation and loopholes with respect to Canadian sales of arms and weapons components to Israel via the United States. The United States, Russia, and China, 3 of the 4 major arms exporting countries accounting for more than half of all global arms transfers, are not party to the treaty, and they are unlikely to come on board anytime soon. All true. But still, how far we have come. As Cesar Jaramillo, the former executive director of Project Plowshares, told me, it is a huge step forward to have a binding legal framework that brings human rights rules to arms transfers. Pundits doubted it would be possible to get states to agree to limit their trade in weapons. They underestimated people power. The point is this. When we believe, when we are empowered and bound to one another in solidarity, when we spread the word and protest, when we overcome doubt by making human rights real, when we defend human rights, when we set out to make change happen, even against enormous odds, we can and do prevail. And that means that we all must join in to show that everyone, every single one of us, does belong, and that we will not allow anyone to be left to the side. Our collective determination has advanced the universal promise of human rights in the past. It can and must do so again. The Charter of the United Nations does, after all, begin with these 3 words. We, the peoples. Thank you.
Every single one of us does belong in defence of an urgent and renewed commitment to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which started with all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. Rounding off that stirring series of Massey lectures presented by the former Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada, human rights lawyer, activist advocate, adjunct professor at the University of Ottawa, Alex Neave. And the series is also in book form. The book is called Universal: Renewing Human Rights in a Fractured World. And you can share our episodes with your friends. Look for Big Ideas on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And we love it when you say to others, hey, did you hear this? And send that episode on. and when you email us your reflections to bigideas@abc.net.au. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.